Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of Syria, the DREAM Act, and the future of 800,000 young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the U.S. as children, and the San Francisco Board of Supervisors' decision to replace Acting Mayor London Breed with Supervisor Mark Farrell as a caretaker mayor until the June 5th election. Today, we are kicking it off with Syria. Syria's seven-year-old devastating civil war has been getting less and less attention in the media. The war in Syria has left more than 400,000 dead. Millions are now refugees. At least half of Syria's pre-war population of 20 million has been displaced. Today's guest, Martin Chulov, reports that another 200,000 were on the move in Idlib before Turkey's military assault on the Kurdish enclave of Afrin, and after Russian jets and Iranian-backed ground forces launched an attack on the nearby province. So who is controlling what in Syria? Martin Chulov is an award-winning journalist covering the Middle East for The Guardian, and Martin joins us from Istanbul. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to the show.
Always a pleasure, Rose.
It's always a pleasure to have you, Martin. And as you know, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention?
There's a piece in The Guardian, nothing to do with my beat, but very much to do with the U.S. It was a piece by Gary Young, our editor-at-large, about how the far right has perfected the art of deniable racism. We call it in the UK a dog whisper in many ways. It's words that you don't necessarily speak, but the meaning is very vivid, very clear. And there's clearly been a palatable licensing of darkest instincts, not just in the US, but around Europe, Australia and elsewhere over the last year or so. And I do think that the Trump administration directly appeals to that base. And this piece by Gary Young articulate that in a very compelling way.
Yeah, I saw that piece. And quickly, Martin, because you cover the Middle East and you are overseas, what do you make of what you are seeing right now in the United States, specifically when you read about this kind of racism?
Well, it's astounding to see how things that have been, that the regimes in this part of the world have gotten away with for so long, are being replicated on a daily basis and amplified in the U.S., where institutions are clearly under immense pressure. People who don't believe in plurality or power sharing or any sense of democracy in this part of the world are taking comfort from what they're seeing in the U.S. And that's something that really does directly affect my beat, because there is no sense of an alternative now, or deterrence, or there just seems to be a culture of impunity. Anything goes. Racism, bigotry, prejudice, sexism, all of these things are okay now. They've been licensed.
You've made that point before, Martin, on the show in the past, that what the President of the United States says has dramatic impacts on the rest of the world.
Absolutely. In the Middle East, where we see rising tyranny almost at every turn, there is it's very clearly part of the conversation that, look, the U.S. is like this, that this social liberalism, progressivism, that was an experiment. It was an exception to the norm. The norm is what we see now, and that is a centralized authority, limited civic space, a base civil discourse, and a formula which is you can have some limited freedoms, but just don't go into any of the seat of power.
Martin, Syria is getting less and less attention here in the United States media. What does it look like in the UK, for example? Is it still getting attention?
It isn't, and it's something that I reflect on often. I've been responsible for most of our Syria coverage over the last 6 years, and it has been difficult to get the attention of readers and editors, and understandably in many ways. It's just a relentless menu of suffering and misery, and it doesn't appear that, you know, it is an age of narrative, and narrative is cut through truth here, and that's quite demoralizing to many people. And I think it's incumbent on myself and my colleagues to find new ways to tell this essential story. I mean, we talk about scandal overload or trauma overload, and we look at that in Syria, where you see 200,000 people in the move around Idlib. I mean, years ago, that in itself would have got global attention pretty quickly. Now it's just another talking point, and it somehow melts into a Turkish invasion of Syria, the Russians and the Iranians carving up what remains of post-war Syria, Assad claiming a Pyrrhic victory, and the real risk of the country being torn apart along ethnic sectarian lines.
And I'm guessing that some of our listeners maybe don't even know about the Turkish invasion of Syria. As you point out in one of your latest pieces, Martin, it's an increasingly complex war. It has displaced at least half of Syria's pre-war population of 20 million. You have been writing about Russia and Iranian-backed ground forces. And before we get into details, Martin, for people who are not following this closely, can you give us a sense of who is controlling what in Syria right now?
Right. So over the last 6 years, the what started off as a civil war, as a civic uprising, which spawned into a military insurrection, was quickly joined. Actually, I shouldn't say quickly. It was joined by late 2012, and that was more or less a year and a bit after the initial protests in southern Syria and in and around Homs. It soon became a regional proxy war in many ways, with Turkey in particular backing and arming the Syrian opposition in the north, the Qataris involved as well, and the Saudis and the Americans belatedly. Now, on the other side, you had the regime of Bashar al-Assad, which was fighting for survival. They were backed by Iran very early on, and by Russia in September 2015. Russia provided an air force, the Iranians provided direction to ground forces, and by mid last year the tide had turned and it became a situation where the opposition could no longer win the war. Turkey had lost enthusiasm for backing the opposition, and now we're at a point where every one of these players, Turkey, Russia and Iran in particular, are looking to carve their own influence out of the ruins of the country. And that's where we get to the Turkish invasion of northern Syria earlier this week, which was primarily aimed at taking on a small Kurdish community in the northwest. The Americans, who have been backing a Kurdish community in the northeast in the fight against the Islamic State, made an announcement prior to the Turkish invasion, which was they were going to turn this Kurdish force into a border force. Turkey saw that as a strategic threat because it has always maintained that Kurds from southeastern Turkey, the PKK, with whom it is fighting a four-decade insurgency, are instructive in the Syrian Kurdish forces in the northeast and the northwest. And that's how we got to the point where we are today.
Can you talk about the decision behind why Turkey decided to attack Afrin? I mean, you mentioned a little bit of it, but what is Turkey's end game here?
Well, the end game is essential, and it starts with, as I said, there are Kurds in the northwest of Syria. There's a large Kurdish swathe in the northeast. In the middle is a 60-mile gap. That's controlled more or less by Arab communities, and Turkey has been adamant for the last 3 years that gap will not be closed. In other words, that Kurds will not fill it, because that would therefore change the color of the entire 800-mile border between Turkey and Syria, and Turkey's assessment is that would pose a strategic threat to its borders and beyond. So first and foremost, they've been determined to keep that 60-mile gap in the hands of Arab forces. Last year, they did arm proxy Arab forces to keep that gap pretty much in the hands of people that they trust and like. But as I said, the decision by the Americans, by the Pentagon in particular, to say that now that the fight against ISIS is all but done and dusted militarily in the northeast of the country, the Kurdish forces that the Americans had used as proxies are going to be formed into a more permanent border force, which would have quite significant strategic input into that part of the country. Now, Turkey's outraged by it, but it doesn't want to take on the Americans and the Kurds in the northeast. Instead, in the northwest, it has a small pocket, a town called Afrin, where there is a substantial Kurdish population. That is an easy target within easy reach of its borders. Beyond that, if this operation is successful, this military operation, I do think Turkey is going to look to establish some kind of a buffer zone, which would involve a demographic shift, potentially shifting those Kurds out of the town of Afrin by force and moving in populations that it's more comfortable with.
We're speaking with Martin Chulov, an award-winning journalist covering the Middle East for The Guardian. He has been covering Syria for the last 6 years. And if you have any questions or comments about this media coverage, it's not getting as much attention as it was a few years ago, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Martin, how many people live in this Kurdish enclave of Afrin?
The population pre-war is around about 65,000. At the war, things have changed. There have been groups moving in and out. It is difficult to gauge, but I think a good guess now would be close to 50,000, and it's right up on the Turkish border.
Can you talk about how you get this information as a reporter? Can you go into Syria at this point?
I was in the northeast and in and around Raqqa late last year. It's possible to cross there from Iraqi Kurdistan, but entering Syria from the Turkish border is very, very difficult. The Turks aren't letting many people through. There was a BBC correspondent there yesterday, CNN earlier in the week, but they do pick and choose. So it's difficult to cover this campaign from inside. The Turks have been rather rigid about what they expect from coverage, and the clear, explicit threat of being kicked out of the country if reporters embed themselves with the Syrian Kurds in Afrin. So it's difficult to do so from on the ground, but over many years you develop contacts where we can speak to people. We know I've been going to Syria for 6 years now. I know the essence of what's going on there, and we stay in touch with people we've met over many years.
According to the Middle East Eye, government ministers have ordered the Turkish media to follow a 15-point guide on reporting the invasion of Afrin, urging them to promote Turkish-made weapons used in the battle, ignore foreign media due to its infiltration by Kurdish sympathizers, and to trust only government statements as true.
Well, I can't corroborate it, but it sounds about right. I mean, the Turks have been very determined to control the narrative here. And certainly some of those points that you outlined there have been made separate of this campaign. So I very much doubt that document is false.
What about the Syrian people, Martin? As you have reported, at least half of Syria's pre-war population of 20 million have been displaced. I mean, this is a massive number.
Yeah, it's upwards of 10 million people, either internally displaced or forced across the borders. Those who are internally displaced are basically hiding out in areas which are still controlled by the opposition. One of them is Idlib, and Idlib is problematic because it is the one part of the country where the original Assad narrative of it being largely about or all about jihad is more or less true. It's become a self-fulfilling prophecy there. And what we've seen over the past year in particular is Syrian populations from elsewhere in the country have surrendered, and as part of that surrender, they've been relocated to Idlib, where they've been mixed up with jihadis who do run the province. And that is dangerous because it has created all the ingredients for what could conceivably be a kill box, the last province of the country that's outside Syrian control. And with the world turning away with so much apathy, so much fatigue about Syria, we've seen the impunity which has governed this conquest become even more heightened. There are daily bombings, there are daily atrocities in and around Idlib, notwithstanding Afrin, which aren't being covered. And when the blowtorch of scrutiny isn't put on this story, then just encourages more outrages, and I'm afraid that's where we are.
What about the U.S. role, Martin? Secretary of State Rex Tillerson recently said that the U.S. will maintain an indefinite military presence in Syria. Do you know how many Americans are currently on the ground there?
It was around 2,000, and they are They are exclusively confined to supporting the Kurdish force in the northeast of the country called the Syrian Democratic Forces in the fight against the Islamic State. Now, they've remained there as that battle has subsided. The ISIS, the Islamic State, have all but been militarily defeated in Syria. There's only pockets in which they're holding out. Now, the 2,000 Americans will stay there, but in that Tillerson statement, which was meant to be a strategic outline of the American presence from here, it wasn't entirely clear whether those forces would be used for anything other than mopping up operations, or whether they may be diverted into any other sort of offensive. Now, I imagine that they're just going to stay put, and then their presence starts in a town called Manbij, which the Turks have threatened to invade in the last couple of days. So that's just on the eastern edge of that 60-mile gap that I was talking about earlier.
Before we let you go, Martin, we have a call. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. There are often like little things on the news that will strike me. This particular one had to do with the German government deciding to stop supplying tanks to the Turkish government, and that in the face of the fact that the Russians seem to have stepped out of the situation, and now the Turks are objecting strongly to the United States support for the Kurds. Do you think that the other nations are stepping back from the situation, and that now the United States is going to be facing Turkey?
The German decision has quite deep roots. Germany and Turkey have been at odds over the last couple of years on Germany's stand towards, primarily Germany's stand towards the human rights situation in Turkey, but it's also spreads into other issues. There are differences on the PKK, there are differences on immigration, and there's been quite a bitter diplomatic standoff there, and I think that's been amplified by the invasion. In terms of the Russians, and they talk often about withdrawing, but they've still got a very significant military presence in Syria. They've done a lot of the heavy lifting for Assad, and he wouldn't be in a winning position were it not for them. They will gradually withdraw, but only when it suits their interests. And as for the Americans and the Turks, there is more of a threat of a direct standoff there, or even a direct clash, particularly in and around the town of Manbij, which I mentioned just earlier. But I get the sense that after all of the bluster here, I think both sides will recognize how significant the stakes are and how damaging it would be if that stepped over the line. So I'm not anticipating there to be direct military clashes, but I do think that diplomatic tensions are more strained than they have been in many years.
Well, thank you for calling, William. Before we let you go, Martin, what options do the Kurds have at this point?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question, Rose. They've had a history of being abandoned by so-called allies. They can't afford to take on the Turks. They will end up being defeated in Afrin. Turkey is flying an air force at them. They simply can't defend it. In recent days, in the last 48 hours, they have reached out to the Syrian regime itself, looking for support. Now, that's an interesting play, and I think it's probably their only play. There'd be a price to pay for it. The Syrians would want them the regime would want them to down tools and to rejoin the fold and potentially to fight the jihadists in Idlib province. So, you know, wherever they look, it's going to be a difficult and bloody short-term future for the Kurds.
Well, Martin, thank you for your reporting, and thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Martin Chulov is an award-winning journalist covering the Middle East for The Guardian. He's been covering Syria for the last 6 years. He was joining us from Istanbul. He reports that at least half of Syria's pre-war population of 20 million have been displaced. That's more than 10 million people. And you can find Martin's latest reporting at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to talk about the Dreamers. The Dreamers have become a bargaining chip between the White House and the Democrats. Last Friday, 33 Senate Democrats voted for the spending bill, even though it did not include protections for almost 800,000 undocumented immigrants who were brought here as children. According to the New York Times, Senator Chuck Schumer offered Donald Trump funding for his wall in exchange for protecting young immigrants. Of course, that did not happen. In fact, Trump has shifted his position on the DREAM Act many, many times. Joining us to discuss coverage is Megan Janetsky. Megan is a reporter with OpenSecrets.org in Washington. She spent 4 months interviewing Dreamers as uncertainty looms. Maria Pena, one of Arizona's almost 28,000 DACA recipients, asks, should I be planning for the worst? And Megan wrote a story for Think Progress called Should I Be Planning for the Worst? Uncertainty Looms as Dreamers Fight for Justice. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start off talking about the politics because you are in Washington. And I mean, Democrats, 33 Dems voted for the spending bill. They are being criticized by so many groups, especially immigrant rights groups. In fact, some Latino groups say that they're going to leave the Democratic Party over this. And then you've got Trump coming up with all of these different plans, shifting his position. I mean, at one point a few weeks ago when he was meeting with senators, Senator Dianne Feinstein said, we want a clean DACA bill. And he said, sounds great. And then the Republicans next to him said, no, you don't want to do that. I mean, the guy clearly doesn't know what he's doing and changes his mind on a regular basis. What is the latest right now on the Dreamers coming out of Washington?
I mean, I think it's been a lot of the same in the sense that Dreamers have historically been used as a bargaining chip to by two very, very polarized parties. The Democrats and the Republicans right now aren't on the same page in terms of comprehensive immigration reform. Dreamers tend to be the only sort of middle ground there is in that sense. So we're seeing them being used as a bargaining chip in a lot of ways to get a ramp up in enforcement by the Trump administration.
And right now, the government will be open for the next couple of weeks. The government will run for the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. What do we expect will happen in February?
Oh, that's largely up in the air. I mean, a DREAM Act has been on the table, or a DACA fix has been on the table for years and years and years. So it may shut down again. Probably not. There's a conversation being had right now, a promise by Republicans saying that they are going to have open negotiations about like DACA and just border enforcement generally. So generally, we don't really know what's going to happen on March 5th. There's no promises. It's been incredibly up in the air.
And Megan reports that DACA, which began in 2012, allowed undocumented immigrants to live, work, and study in the U.S., but that legal lifeline took a turn in September when the Trump administration announced the end of the program. And then after March 5th, 2018, DACA permits will gradually begin to expire. In fact, some estimate that around 1,000 DACA recipients will begin losing their status every day. Today, we are speaking with Megan Janetsky. She's a reporter with OpenSecrets.org in Washington, D.C., and she spent 4 months interviewing Dreamers as uncertainty looms. One of the young women she interviewed, Maria Pena, who's from Arizona, her DACA status is expected to end in July of 2019. This is your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 at noon, it's 2 hours of 1A from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, it's our One Planet series. We'll be speaking with writer and environmental activist Subhankar Banerjee about the Trump administration's plans to open nearly all U.S. coastal waters and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling. We're talking about more than 1 billion acres in fragile ecosystems. They're in danger. We'll find out how groups are fighting back. Next week, we'll also be joined by Jody Jacobson. She's the editor-in-chief of Rewire, a website that focuses on reproductive justice. And then later in the week, David K. Johnston will join us to talk about his latest book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we're joined by Megan Janetsky, a reporter with OpenSecrets.org in Washington. Megan spent 4 months interviewing dreamers who, a lot of them said, I cannot focus on my studies because I have to travel to D.C. on a regular basis and educate politicians and people about DACA. And you can find the piece she wrote for Think Progress at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions or comments about how this issue, immigration, is being covered in the media, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You profiled a number of the young people that you met when you traveled from Arizona to Washington. A number of these young people, also known as dreamers, talked to lawmakers about their futures. How did you connect with these young people?
So for 4 months, I followed Maria and her family, who are dreamers based in Arizona, which is where I was from and where I was reporting from this past fall. And Maria, I had spent a lot of time with their family and their home and just following her around her general life. And in December, when things were ramping up regarding a spending bill in Washington, she invited me to follow her and a group of dreamers as they drove across the United States to advocate in Washington, D.C.
Tell us a little bit about Maria Pena. She's 20 years old. When did she come to the U.S.?
She came to the U.S. when she was very young. I believe it was either 5 or 6, with her brother, who was 2 months old at the time. She is a student. She works multiple jobs, and because her mom works tirelessly, usually late into the night, she's kind of had to raise her two younger brothers, one who is a DACA recipient himself and one who is a U.S. citizen.
You write that, I mean, you met them in Arizona. Between the three siblings and their friends, they were cramped in a Paradise Valley trailer. The trailer park was home to the family and had been for most of Pena's life in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And she was matched with members of Congress, and you traveled with them in December. It was 40 degrees, very, very cold. The wind was kicking in, and you have a photo of her in the story walking with Representative Ed Perlmutter, a Democrat from Colorado, on his way to vote outside the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, the Dreamers have been going back and forth to Washington for a while now, and I mean, these are kids who are in some cases supplementing incomes from their families, trying to get good grades so they can go to college. Can you talk to us about the trips they take to D.C.?
Yeah, well, she wasn't matched necessarily, but essentially the goal of the group was to reach out and talk to as many members of Congress as possible and kind of put a face to, you know, their, like, dreamers, who have been kind of a buzzword in recent weeks, months, years. And essentially quite a few of them came from all over the U.S., to just advocate and kind of tell their stories. And one thing that they said that I witnessed myself was that their stories are harder to dispute, in the sense that, like, you can talk politics regarding, like, border enforcement and undocumented immigrants, but it's very hard to dispute someone's personal life experience, and that's kind of how Maria and her group went about talking to members of Congress, simply telling their stories.
What is the response? What kind of response do they get from politicians?
It was a mixed response. Some of them continued walking to vote. Some of them, and like kind of ignoring them. Some of them were very open to just like having like conversations and learning more about the Dreamers. And then some of them would kind of continue walking and be like, yeah, yeah, we're on your side. And that's vastly different. I've talked to Dreamers who were there in 2013 when, you know, comprehensive immigration reform was on the table. And a lot of them said that, you know, they were called like illegal immigrants. And there was just a very clear distinction between then and now.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you see any Democratic politicians ignore them?
I mean, I think a lot of Democratic, I don't think I personally saw any of them just walk straight forward and just pretend they didn't exist. But there are certainly some that waved them off, and I think that's like representative of a lot of Congress, and not necessarily like to bash on Congress. That's not kind of what I meant by that, but more in the sense that they, like, Dreamers have been in and out of Washington quite a bit, so they've had these conversations a lot. That it, there's been an extensive effort by advocacy groups to really get Dreamers out to Washington, D.C.
You write that the groups came from many, many states, Arizona, California, Texas, Washington, Oregon, Kansas. Over the course of a month, one organization brought 83 DACA recipients, immigrants, and advocates to the Capitol. By night, around 30 immigrants slept on the floor of a local church. By day, they packed the few possessions they could fit in the vans into a church closet and then headed to the Capitol, donning walking shoes and button downs. What do you think, Megan, of media coverage? Because in addition to writing about Dreamers, where they came from, what their situations are like, this is also important. You write that to grow up undocumented was to grow up with a lingering fear, scared to do even the smallest things, like go to the hospital or take a road trip. Maria Pena said, told you, I remember being scared of the cops because we knew. My parents would talk about it when I was 5 years old. I had a bit of an idea. I just knew that we were better off here.
Mm-hmm. So I think, and I can just speak on how a lot of DACA recipients view media coverage, is there's been a lot of discontentment in the sense that I think a lot of organizations in the news cycle tend to hit the topic but not go in depth. So what a lot of recipients told me when I asked them personally was that they were kind of glazed over and clumped together as a group. They were like people, the general like Dreamer narrative is that there's this perfect student fitting all the descriptions of like a perfect person with Ivy League expectations and just like goals. But in reality, this is a very dynamic group. These are different people from different walks of life. Some have gotten political, some haven't. Some want to go to the Ivy League. Some just want to work and live their lives. So I think the main qualm also with like a lot of media coverage was that by portraying Dreamers as such, it almost criminalizes other immigrants that are, you know, not living, like just trying to live their lives.
Right.
And that was just a qualm that was brought up to me quite a bit by Dreamers I talked to.
Yeah, it's such a good point. When we've done shows about immigration in the past, the guests have said, we do not want to pit immigrants against each other. You know, this is the ideal immigrant. Look, she's going to Harvard, versus, you know, this person comes in year after year to work in the fields and sends money back home.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what do you think? I'm noticing now that there are more stories, like the front page of today's New York Times. The headline says it all. Most Americans want legal status for Dreamers. These people don't. And this piece is just full of even some immigrants saying that they want these Dreamers to be deported. In fact, NPR had a story yesterday and quoted some people who said the same thing. What are your thoughts about this kind of reporting?
I mean, I think in the sense that everyone has a voice, and so I'm not, like, certainly opposed to it, but I just think a lot of reporting I see on the topic and immigration and perhaps just generally sometimes, it doesn't dive deep into the phenomenon that's happening, because there's a lot of complexity to the issue of DACA. There's a lot of complexity to, like, you know, the immigration system. So to kind of play it off with just like a couple quotes, I don't think necessarily does the issue justice. I haven't personally read this New York Times piece, so I can't speak too much on that, but that's just kind of what I've seen in a lot of coverage in the past couple months, because I've been following it fairly heavily.
And Megan, before we let you go, there have been so many horrendous, very sad stories about people who have been deported, people who've been here for decades, who have families here, and they are being deported to countries they don't know. And in many cases, they have targets on their backs. What do you think about that reporting? I mean, it's one family will get a lot of focus, and then there will be a video about that family. And I'm just thinking about the families that aren't getting the media attention.
I mean, I think that it's a large demographic, and I will say, because I know quite a few, like, immigration reporters, that I think that reporters are trying to do their best in covering this topic, and there's so much and such a heavy news cycle, especially in terms of immigration, that I think it's really hard to keep up with it. You can't ask every single immigrant kind of what their story is, though I think it's bold and important to try. But I think it's just important for reporters to try and dig deep on these issues, because they are deep issues.
And we talked briefly about what the Dreamers told you. What other anxieties did they share with you? A lot of them said that it's really hard to even focus on their studies because they don't know what's to come, and then they have to plan trips to go to D.C. to advocate for themselves and for other immigrants.
Well, not necessarily even planning trips to D.C. I just think there's a massive level of uncertainty with every single one I talk to, where some have families who are like younger children who are U.S. citizens that they don't know if they're going to be separated. There are some where they like just want to get their degree and don't know if they're able to. Some have businesses in the U.S. I mean, there's a plethora of things, and it boils down to these people don't know what their future is, and that's what they told me, and that's the core of, I think, anxiety.
Are you still in touch with the young people you profiled?
Yeah, I mean, I've kept in touch with a lot of them. Maria's, like, still pursuing their degree. I, you know, the story just ran, like, last month, so I do talk to them every once in a while.
Well, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Megan Janetsky is a reporter with OpenSecrets.org in Washington. She spent 4 months interviewing Dreamers, and you can find the piece she wrote for Think Progress called Should I Be Planning for the Worst? Uncertainty Looms as Dreamers Fight for Justice. That's at yourcallradio.org. And now we are going to talk about what is happening here in San Francisco. It was a very surprise and shocking move. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors ousted the acting mayor, London Breed, and voted in Mark Farrell to be the caretaker mayor until the election on June 5th. And joining us to talk about coverage and talk about what went down is Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez. Joe is a political columnist and transportation reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. I was following your tweets. You were in the room that night. What was it, Tuesday night?
Tuesday night.
Joe, you closely follow San Francisco politics. How surprising was this to you?
Well, you know, going into it, I had heard the rumors, as many political reporters and those in the kind of political insiders had heard, that Farrell was going to be up for that vote. But to be honest with you, it had not occurred to me that that was actually something that could be pulled off. I did not think they would get the sixth vote, and the reason why is because you cannot vote for yourself when you are voting for this successor mayor. And so I thought the five moderates and five progressives were going to be completely deadlocked. But what was a surprise was the moderate Democrat supervisor, Jeff Sheehy, who represents the Castro and Noe Valley, which is District 8, flipping to the side of the progressives and handing Mark Farrell that win.
And for people who have not been following this, because we air outside of San Francisco, Mayor Ed Lee passed away on December 12th. No one saw this coming, right? It was a shock to the city. Now, Supervisor London Breed is president of the Board of the Supervisors. So by default, she became the interim mayor. We are going to now have an election because of Ed Lee's death on June 5th. Can you give listeners more information about just the process involved, just in terms of the board president becoming the interim mayor and why this was so controversial?
Sure. I mean, you know, what I find really interesting is actually something you pegged in your statement just now, which is that, you know, there is such little information to people outside of San Francisco and even people in San Francisco who don't necessarily follow politics very closely. From the outside and from people who maybe don't follow politics as closely, the story is simply this. The first potential black woman mayor of San Francisco, who was serving as acting mayor, was ousted for a white venture capitalist with more conservative-leaning policies by San Francisco standards. That's the viewpoint of many, and it certainly is what happened in one sense. But by the sheer rote rules of it, the city charter of San Francisco says, and I have it in front of me, so I'll just read it to you, if the office of mayor becomes vacant because of death, resignation, recall, permanent disability, or inability to carry out the responsibilities of the office, the president of the Board of Supervisors shall become acting mayor and shall serve until a successor is appointed by the Board of Supervisors. So the acting mayor position is almost like the vice president taking over for a president in the event of a death, except for the charter says, well, hey, once that acting mayor is in, the board will appoint a successor mayor. And that's what we saw. That vote Tuesday where London lost and Farrell was in was by the rules of process of voting a successor. Now, why they voted against London, there's a lot of accusations flying. People are saying it was racist. People are saying it was sexist. I was in City Hall, I was in the room, and supporters of London, many of whom were black, many of whom were women, were saying, you are all racists. This is war. And that message is largely carried through the news coverage from the New York Times to Breitbart News everywhere. Mm. And your mother, that has been the impression. But my impression is that it was just politics. It really is just politics. The progressives have not sided with London all that often in the past 4 years of her, you know, supervisorship, you know, or the past years of her supervisorship. They have been, 6 years. They have been on opposite sides for a long time. London, for instance, wanted to take the low-income housing that is guaranteed when developments are made for low-income people and divide that pie up and give more to middle-income earners by taking some of that housing away from low-income earners. Progressives were fighting that tooth and nail for months, especially Supervisor Aaron Peskin, who is widely credited as the city lawmaker who orchestrated the vote to put Mark Farrell in office. And so they were political opponents for a very long time on lots of controversial issues. Jane Kim, for instance, who was another person who opposed, voted for Mark Farrell, you know, was one of the first to call for the ouster of Police Chief Sir after the killings of black and brown people in San Francisco by San Francisco police. London did not call for the ouster of Chief Sir, though she does have a strong record in some other areas of police reform. So there's a lot of policy differences here that people are not necessarily discussing as they're discussing kind of the other elements of this decision.
Joe, I'm so glad you brought this up because I think that the coverage has really lacked any substance. There have been criticisms, and we can talk about this in a minute, of London Breed's support and connections to Ron Conway, the venture capitalist in San Francisco, as well as tech. But it kind of stops there. I mean, she's got a record. She's been in office for 6 years. What else can you tell us about London Breed's record?
Yeah, I mean, you know, London Breed has pushed for more housing development. You know, I wouldn't say, like, you know, this is necessarily a huge indictment on London Breed's entire record. I would say, to be fair, London has had some record of mostly supporting the moderate wing of Democrats in San Francisco, with siding with progressives on some issues. But she also, you know, linking this back to Ron Conway and why Ron Conway, a tech mogul who is an early investor in Airbnb and Google Matters, is because for a while, London was on the side of people who were not pushing for tougher regulations of Airbnb. Later on, when the issue became more untenable and she was in an election against a progressive named Dean Preston, and you could take that as you will, she did come over to the side of pushing for more regulations of Airbnb. But that was a big deal. We're in a rental crisis. We are losing rental stock in the city of San Francisco, and rents are soaring. And we're losing that rental stock to Airbnb units being occupied when we could be renting to the people who are losing their homes. So the idea that that people would push against Airbnb regulations was a thing that lit progressives up, and London was for a long time on the other side of that argument. So until she finally came around later on. So there are legislative positions that progressives had extremely huge disagreements with London Breed, from Airbnb to the housing that I mentioned, to policing. I mean, you know, she more than anyone knows what it's like to lose people to police violence. You know, she's known tons of people in the community who have been shot and killed, and that's a big deal. But she also, you know, has a very tight relationship with the police. She has taken money from the Police Officers Association, the police union, and they have had given her support in the past. Before, again, she kind of turned her changed her tune a little bit on that one as well. But those were, by San Francisco standards, more kind of centrist Democrat positions, and the progressives are far to the left of her, and that is the driving force. And they are looking to and they are supporting Jane Kim and Mark Leno in their mayoral runs. And just quite frankly, in a pure political sense, they want Mark Leno, former state senator, to be mayor, or Jane Kim, who is the current city supervisor and a Korean woman or a gay man, to be mayor. And they didn't want London Breed to be mayor, so they were doing something to prevent that that would take away some support for London Breed's mayoral run.
Joe, right before the vote, Supervisor Hillary Ronan, who represents the Mission, said that the same rich white men that steered the policies that have created the mess we're in today are the same people who are firmly behind London Breed. Hillary Ronan said they've been bullying anyone they can to force people to support President Breed, including threatening people's careers if they don't support her. Hillary Ronan was on Forum a couple of days ago, and she said that she can be honest about this because she ran on a platform that big tech does not support. She said that a number of her colleagues cannot be honest about what's going on behind the scenes. And again, I wish we had more information about this. This is getting attention, but it kind of stops on the surface. I mean, Hillary Ronan basically said that people are being bullied behind the scenes, that Ron Conway was at Ed Lee's funeral telling people to vote for London Breed. What is really happening? I mean, how much influence does Ron Conway really have on politics in San Francisco?
You know, I don't want to paint it as if Ron Conway is a vastly intelligent schemer and puppet master moving chess pieces across the board. It's not as grand as that. It's as simple as this. He's got money, a lot of money. There are big thinkers and strategists other than him who are allied with him, who supported the late Mayor Ed Lee and other more centrist Democrats in San Francisco who are more pro-business, pro-tech, and pro-development. And, you know, those folks rely on Conway's money to make some of those things happen. I have some of Conway's finances in front of me just a second ago for a story I'm writing, and you know, he can drop $50,000 into what's essentially a local version of a super PAC and spend it wherever he would like on, you know, a proposition, a ballot proposition to change taxes or loosen taxes for the tech industry, or something regarding homelessness. He spent tens of thousands of dollars to unseat Aaron Peskin in the local version of a super PAC, which we call an independent expenditure committee. You know, the power of Conway is the power of his purse, and it is as simple as that. And strategists who support London Breed's allies and London Breed rely on that. And what that means, though, is that they are going to expect something in return. I'm not saying that London has guaranteed those things. London has repeatedly said, you know, I'm independent, I do what I will. But at some point, when you're taking, when you have taken that much money, you will be, someone will hold you accountable for that money.
Before we let you
And as far as as far as the funeral goes, that was from my reporting. A lot of this actually was based on my previous reporting from the people who told me that, you know, that Conway had said those things at the private funeral. And frankly, you know, that wasn't political. Those were friends of Mayor Ed Lee, people who had known him for decades, who were pissed. Everyone in that room was someone who was a friend of Mayor Ed Lee's. There were very few, if any, true politicians in that room at Mayor Ed Lee's funeral. And the people who were angry were just people who knew Ed Lee and thought that Ron Conway was politicking over his dead body. And it was just shocking. Hmm. It was just absolutely shocking. And as far as the bullying goes, we will not really get true accounting of this, sadly, because the people who were bullied had the most to lose in terms of being countered by Ron Conway's purse.
Well,
they don't want to talk.
Hillary Ronan's going public with it.
Right, but she's already going to be opposed by Ron Conway's purse. That was already a given for her, so she has nothing to lose to say it.
Right, but she's saying that her colleagues who cannot speak, I mean, she basically says she's speaking for them also because she says they cannot speak openly about this.
No, absolutely. And and progressive supervisors have been voicing it. In my first column about this, and I was the one who outed, you know, Conway's, you know, tactics behind the scenes, you know, the only person who would speak on the record was Aaron Peskin at the time. And it's because he's a progressive and he's already opposed by Conway's money. And he can speak openly about it. But other people who would speak to me under condition of anonymity are people who are most threatened.
And just quickly, Joe, Art says major media are not reporting the underlying political reasons for the opposition to London Breed. What's the most effective way? Write letters to the editor, email journalists? What would you say, Joe?
Oh, to generate this? Well, I don't know. Like, people, I hate to say it because my whole everything I do is based around reporting the nuance of these politics, but people don't always have the appetite for that nuance. There's an easy narrative of a black woman being dethroned from public housing, being dethroned for a white venture capitalist, and that, well, there's truth to that because that is what happened. That narrative lacks a lot of detail, and it's a sad thing that people don't always want to sit and listen to those details or know the details. The easy narrative is easier. If they do really want to reach out, if they do want to know more, I suggest reading some of our coverage in the Examiner, not only mine, but that of my colleagues. And you know, write letters to the editor. Absolutely. Write letters to the editor. Post publicly about it. Call into shows like yours. Absolutely. But also say things publicly. If you show up at the Board of Supervisors, if you call out the records of people or ask to hear the records of people, the supervisors will address it. Politicians will address it, and that also helps generate news.
Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez is a political columnist with The Examiner. Find one of his latest pieces, Tech Mogul Ron Conway Shakes Down Supervisors to Support London Breed for Mayor, at yourcallradio.org. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you so much, Rose.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.